When I tell nice guys, you need to make yourself your number one priority in life, they get a deer in the headlight looks. Oh, no, that'll make me a bad person. That'll make me like my father or all those jerks I've heard women complain about. But no, the true sign of maturity. In fact, I think the number one characteristics of a mature adult is a person who takes full responsibility for both their actions and their needs and their wants. Now, we can't get all of our needs and wants met by ourselves. Now, we can get a good start at it. We can get up and drink water and do some exercise and do some meditation. We can do a lot of things to nurture ourselves, but we need a lot of people around us. We need a posse. I call these cooperative reciprocal relationships. We need a lot of both friends, professionals, practices, different things that fill our bucket. From there, we can give from the overflow.
What's up, guys? Welcome to the Michaela Peterson podcast. This is episode number 105, and I'm hosting Dr. Robert Glover. Yes, this was a doozy of an episode. A doozy. He's a marriage and family therapist, although he mostly focuses on coaching men. He's the author of the best-selling book, No More Mr. Nice Guy. We had some very interesting topics to cover. We talked about what the issues are with being a nice guy or nice girl, for that matter. We talked about his experience learning how to be compassionate but not resentful, discussed his book, relationship advice, expressing inner emotions as men and women, for that matter, and more. It was a good one. If you enjoyed the episode with Adam Lane Smith on relationships, you'll love this one. Dr. Robert Glover is a really smart guy. I hope you enjoy this episode. If you do, please don't forget to subscribe. Dr. Robert Glover, welcome to my podcast.
Oh, good to be here.
I've heard of the book, No More Mr. Nice Guy, for years and years and years. And I'm very excited to get you on here. I think I had one of my other guests tell me about you, although I'd heard of your book. So I think my audience is very interested in this. So
I'm excited to be here. And actually, I just have to say that yesterday I listened to a few of your previous podcasts just to get a flavor. And I listened to a previous guest who mentioned my name. And I thought, wow, that was kind of nice. When he dropped the G-bomb on me, I thought, I don't hear that very often, but it was nice.
That's weirdly coincidental.
Yeah, it's just weird. Well, you know, he was talking about relationships, and I'm all about relationships. So I thought I'll listen to that podcast. And
okay, fair enough. So, that was Adam Lane Smith.
Must have been.
Okay, well, yep, he's the one who told me to get you on. And so now you're here. Before we get started, could you give just a brief background about who you are and what you do for anyone who doesn't know who you are or what you do?
Yeah, I'm, that's a good question. My background is that my training is in marriage and family therapy. I was a marriage and family therapist for a number of years in private practice. And about close to 30 years ago, while I was struggling through my own second marriage, basically my second wife said, "You need to go get some help or I'm leaving you." And I thought I was a nice guy. I was treating her well, treated her better than her ex, was raising her kids. And so I decided, well, okay, I'll go figure out what she means when I'm saying, when she says I'm passive aggressive or I'm this or I'm that. And I had a PhD in marriage and family therapy and didn't even know what passive aggressiveness was. So I joined a 12-step group, got into a men's group, got into therapy, and started realizing that I had an internal life paradigm that if I was a good guy, if I treated everybody well, did everything right, people would love me, like me, I'd get my needs met without having to ask. And realized that wasn't a very effective life paradigm. And so in my counseling with other men and women, I started noticing a lot of guys coming to me with their wives or girlfriends saying the same things I was saying. I'm a nice guy. I treat her better than her ex. I'm raising her kids. I give her everything she wants. I try to make her happy. She's never happy. She never wants to have sex anymore. Blah, blah, blah. And I thought, I can finish these guys' sentences for them. So 25 plus years ago, I started my first No More Mr. Nice Guy men's group and soon added a second. And I just started writing little chapters to give to the guys. And they started saying, Robert, you should write a book. You should go on Oprah. And I kept writing and wrote a book, never got on Oprah. Not yet. But I'm on the Michaela Peterson show. So, you know, that's like, I'm there. So, and so that's been about 25 years I've been working with men. I no longer do private practice. I have an online university. I do workshops and seminars. I do some consultation. I write books. And I now live in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and, you know, have a great life. So that's the nutshell of me and probably how I ended up being talking to you today.
Okay. So what does a nice guy look like the one that you write about in your book?
Okay. And I'll talk about specifically nice guys, but I'll also say that a lot of things I talk about, a lot of your women listeners will probably relate to as well, because there've been nice girls around forever.
Okay. So it's the same, problem for men and women.
At its base, it is. It then manifests often in a little bit different ways for men and women, okay. But the base core paradigm is a nice guy or a nice girl doesn't believe they're okay just as they are. And, you know, we mentioned Adam Lane Smith, and he did a really good job talking about how children internalize at a very young age any negative, painful experience as being caused about them. All children mm-hmm. are very narcissistic. They're the center of their world. And so when something painful happens, we believe I must have caused that, which then turns into a grandiose belief system that has two sides to it. One is that I'm so bad, I cause people to leave me, hurt me, cry, be depressed, drink, yell, scream, whatever. And if I am that powerful to cause that, I also must be powerful enough to prevent that or fix it. So there's these grandiose beliefs that there's something so bad with me that I cause people to leave me or hurt me. And I must be powerful enough to prevent that from ever happening. So nice guys and nice girls basically then grow up. And by the way, this belief system is recorded at a very deep emotional part of our brain. It's recorded in our amygdala, where our emotional operating system is. So this isn't like words we have. It's not an intellectualization. It's not even like visual memory. It's just an emotional belief system down at our operating system that then affects every other part of our brain. And so we grow up to be children, adolescents, adults with a belief system. If I can just be good enough and become what I think other people want me to be, then I'll be liked and loved and get my needs met. And if I can hide anything about me that might get a negative response from other people, then I'll never get abandoned. So men and women both, that if they have these nice guys internalization or attachment issues, as Adam Smith called them, they might manifest differently for a guy than they do for a woman, but the core belief system is the same, is that there's something wrong with me. I'm not good enough. That's typically called toxic shame. I have to become something different, become what other people want me to be, and hide those, whatever that bad thing about me that I think is. And you, for most nice guys, what we tend to hide is our needs, our wants, and our sexuality. So we keep that all under wraps so we don't get a negative reaction from anybody.
Okay. So would that kind of nice person arrive from a childhood that was like overly stressful? Is that where it comes from? Or could it be a regular childhood and then you end up like that anyway?
You know, the word stressful is probably a really good application, because what happens, and I write about this in my book, is when I first started looking at nice guy syndrome, I was looking at me, right? So I thought, I'm a nice guy. How did I become a nice guy? Well, it's probably because I had this type of interaction with my father, this kind of interaction with my mother. I was brought up in a fundamental Christian church that had a lot of, you know, hellfire and brimstone messages, grew up in the 60s and 70s with angry feminism. Every man's a rapist, an erection's a sign of aggression. And so all these got internalized into my emotional brain. And I thought, okay, maybe all other nice guys are just like me, but I quickly came to realize they weren't. There's a lot of different factors. And you mentioned stress, however we might experience stress. And a lot of this has to do with temperament, because you can have two children born into the mm-hmm. same family mm-hmm. with very different temperaments, and they handle the stresses very differently and develop different survival and defense mechanisms. So a lot for what I found with nice guys and nice girls, for many, it partly is just due to our natural temperament. I'm a fairly easygoing, you know, don't rock the boat, want to make everybody happy kind of guy. It's my basic temperament.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So that's part of who I am. And then when you add those stresses, as you speak of, and those stresses would be anything that's painful, uncomfortable. You know, you went through a lot of painful things as a child. I had surgery at 5 days old. And I can just imagine emotionally what that felt like to have, you know, back then, you know, parents didn't come to the waiting room. It wasn't nurturing and soft. And, you know, I probably was just taken away from my parents, put on a cold table, put a mask over my face and wake up in pain. And, you know, how does a child at 5 days old internalize that information? It's not going to be done logically. It's done emotionally. Mm-hmm. And so whatever those stresses might be, it might be, you know, our parents don't get along well. It might be that, you know, that they repress their feelings. It might be that sexuality is repressed in the family. It might be that mom and dad fight a lot. It might be our father was never there. It could be any number of things. It could be that we were hungry and didn't get fed quickly, or we, you know, wet our diaper and didn't get changed quickly. Those kinds of things are the stresses that a child internalizes. I've got to find a way to not keep experiencing these painful experiences. And all children do this, not just nice guys or nice girls. All children develop defense survival mechanisms to try to do two things. Number one, cope with the uncomfortable feelings they're feeling in the moment. So I sucked my thumb till I was in kindergarten. That was a coping mechanism. Some children become needless and wantless. Some cry, some fight, some please, some smile all the time. That's how we try to manage the uncomfortable feelings. The second thing that we try to do is try to prevent the things that cause these uncomfortable feelings from happening again in the future. Now, take all of that bundle of stuff that we just talked about, fast forward that into adolescence and adulthood. We all have that emotional operating system we formalized at a very immature, helpless, dependent stage of life. And we assume that's the way the world works. And we go out into the world functioning from that emotional operating system. And even if, for example, we can't find any big trauma in our life, or our parents are still married and have a good marriage, anything uncomfortable or painful is stressful to a young dependent child.
This episode is brought to you by selfauthoring.com. I thought that was appropriate, giving the episode. Self-authoring was developed by my dad over the last 30 years with help from two other PhDs at McGill and Harvard. The Self-Authoring Suite is a series of online writing programs that collectively help you explore your past, present, and future. I seriously cannot tell you how important it is to write out your traumatic experiences in order to get them out of your head. Hell, you may end up with a book, like me. Writing has been one of the ways I've stayed sane through crazy amounts of stress. Diet too, of course. Sometimes you need to wait, though, before writing out trauma, maybe even a year, so you don't re-traumatize yourself by going over the experiences all over again. The Present Authoring Program has two modules. The first helps you understand and rectify your personality faults. It literally identifies ways that you suck and helps you plan to fix them. It's brutal. The second helps you understand and develop your personality virtues, so it kind of makes up for the faults part. The Future Authoring Program helps you envision a meaningful, healthy, and productive future 3 to 5 years down the road and develop a detailed, implementable plan to make that future a reality. Use code MP. To get 10% off at selfauthoring.com, put your life together, make a plan, stop being useless, etc. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
What's the opposite of the Mr. Nice Guy? Like if your coping mechanism isn't to be nice, like you're explaining, what's the opposite that can happen?
Well, what I call in the book is I call him an integrated male. Now, there could be any number of names, an authentic male, authentic person, integrated person, but basically it's a person who's comfortable with their own feelings. They don't feel like they need to hide anything about themselves. They're open and visible and transparent. They're able to soothe their anxiety and take action rather than trying to manage their anxiety by medicating it away or managing people and situations outside of them. They're honest. They'll tell you what they think, what they feel, they want. They're not pursuing external validation or recognition. They're self-validating through their own actions, through their own sense of integrity. They're what the term, they're differentiated. And differentiation basically is the ability to ask yourself, what do I want? What feels right to me? What does my gut say? And then to follow through on that, even when there's resistance, either between your own ears in terms of neurotic guilt and anxiety.
Guilt, yeah.
And or change back messages from the people around you. That's a differentiated, authentic person that basically lives life on their terms, is a what you see, what you get kind of person, can be open and available to relationship, can be giving and generous, but they're not giving to get. They're just giving as is needed rather than what they need to get validation. So there's a lot of different features that would go with this more authentic, integrated person.
Okay, so I'm probably more on the nice spectrum than the authentic, integrated person.
Okay.
So I'm fairly disagreeable, but I think being sick as a kid and trying to avoid being depressed and trying to avoid stress, like just stressful situations, I'll do things like try and manage situations. So I can see where you're coming from. How do you know, like, isn't there part of, okay, let me just give you an example. Let me try and word this properly. If you're in a situation where you're trying to take care of a family member, doesn't it sometimes benefit to be the nice person?
Okay.
Or is that just always not a good thing to do because there's, you know, guilt wrapped up in it? Like, isn't there some point where you kind of need those kind of people?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you found yourself in that place in life. I have as well. Probably we all do it sometime. Here's the perspective of that is that I don't use the word codependency in my book. And I did that on purpose, mainly because when I wrote the book 25 years ago, the term codependency was primarily only used with women and with like family members of alcoholics. And so I wanted to talk about the dynamic of this giving to get or covert contracts, as I call it, without people getting a predetermined idea of what projecting their own idea of codependency. So the nice guys I talk about, it operates, like I said, from what I call covert contracts. They're if-then propositions. And there's three primary covert contracts of nice guy syndrome. This would be true for guys or girls. One is that if I'm a good person, then I'll be liked and loved. For most men, that also manifests, and the women that I desire to have sex with will want to have sex with me. If I'm a good guy, they'll want to be with me. Second covert contract is that if I meet everybody else's needs without them having to ask, then they will meet my needs without me having to ask. Now, as you can imagine, that's not a very functional way of relating to other people. Third covert contract of nice guy syndrome is if I do everything right, then I'll have a smooth, problem-free life. And this is kind of a
that's what gets me, I think.
Yeah, I do too. I fall, hey, I did everything right. How come you're upset at me? You know, you should do nothing but make my life easy and praise me and appreciate me. I'm the same way. So, but it's a very immature, Peter Pan-ish, oh, if I get everything right, everything in my life will work well. But a couple of problems with that is nobody ever gets everything right. We're human. we're flawed. You know, we're imperfect. And the other part of that is we don't live in a smooth, problem-free, perfect world. We live in a chaotic world. And accepting that the world is chaotic is one step towards maturity, because then we quit trying to manage the chaos. And so going back to your question then, if you are not operating from covert contracts, if you're not giving to get, and in the way I often put it, if you're not giving from an empty bucket, where most codependents, nice guys, nice girls are, because we're not good at making our own needs a priority, our bucket's empty. We give to others hoping that they will then give back, which means that our bucket doesn't usually get filled. And we often have a lot of guilt around taking good care of ourselves or meeting our own needs or making ourselves a priority. When I tell nice guys, you need to make yourself your number one priority in life, they get a deer in the headlight looks. Oh no, that'll make me a bad person. That'll make me like my father or all those jerks I've heard women complain about. But no, a true sign of maturity. In fact, I think the number one characteristics of a mature adult is a person who takes full responsibility for both their actions and their needs and their wants. Now, we can't get all of our needs and wants met by ourselves. Now, we can get a good start at it. We can get up and drink water and do some exercise and do some meditation. We can do a lot of things to nurture ourselves, but we need a lot of people around us. We need a posse. I call these cooperative reciprocal relationships. We need a lot of both friends, professionals, practices, different things that fill our bucket. From there, we can give from the overflow. And we can be generous and we can bless other people's lives and we can give to them what they need to receive, not what we need to give out of our covert contract coming from a place of emptiness. So to come back to your question, if you are taking good care of you, which is essential if you're going to give to anybody else, if you're filling your own bucket in a consistent way, that makes you feel loved and lovable. And then you can give from the overflow with no strings attached, no covert contracts, and give to people what they most need to receive, not what you most need to give to get your covert contracts met. So, yeah, you know, I think I heard you mention you have a young child.
Yes.
Okay.
Scarlett, she's almost four.
Okay. So here's an example of what I call two levels of differentiation. First level of differentiation is where you ask yourself, what feels right to me? What do I want? What do I need? What's important to me? And then you take action to do that. And again, you do it even when you experience the resistance of neurotic guilt or change back from the people around you. Now, there's a second level of differentiation that can only occur after you've achieved first level differentiation. And then you can also ask, what is in the best interest of the people I love? What is in the best interest of the planet that I live on, right? And now from that place, you might actually make some sacrifices. You might actually put yourself second in order to put somebody you love first that needs to be, especially a child or an ill parent. My mother's 86 and had a stroke coming up on 3 years ago. She lives alone, can still drive, but she's fairly disabled physically. And, you know, I live in Mexico. She lives in Seattle. I get up there at least every other month. And people go, oh, you go up to see your mom a lot. They go, yeah, I go up because she lives alone. You know, she doesn't have a lot of social connections. She can't get out a lot. I go up, make sure, you know, it's her during COVID, you know, her pantry is well stocked and that she doesn't have to do a Costco run by herself. And so I can take care of my mother in differentiated ways. Now, as a child, I tried to take care of her in codependent ways because I thought my ability to thrive and survive depended on me sacrificing me to take care of her. I'm now a differentiated adult and I can make sacrifices or I can go out of my way to do things for her. Now, with your daughter, I remember my son's 36. When they're small, you think they're never going to grow up. But, you know, I've got a 14-year-old granddaughter now, so they do grow up pretty quickly. And I remember, you know, when he was a baby that at times, you know, he'd be up all night and, you know, my then wife would come in and say, I can't take it anymore. I can't handle it. You've got to go be with them. And at that time I was a minister. And so like, you know, if it's a Saturday night, I had to get up and preach Sunday morning. And, you know, and I'm thinking, oh, I don't want to go be with a screaming baby. I need my sleep. I got to be good in the morning. And, but you know what? I got up because it was in the best interest of my then wife to let her not be with a screaming baby when she was at her wit's ends and for me to go be with my son. And, you know, believe it or not, some of my fondest memories are of those years when he was a baby, be in the rocking chair. I'd be holding him in my arms, rocking, talking to him, singing to him. And I could give to him because I was already taking good care of me. And we can make those sacrifices to give to others if we're not all sacrificing ourselves. So fill our own bucket and then give from the overflow. And at times we do put ourselves second to make somebody else who needs our attention number one.
Okay. That totally makes sense. So you end up being a better person, right? If you're just giving and it's making you resentful and angry and isolated, then you're not a nice person, really. You just think you're a nice person, right?
You just do. Yeah. And that's actually, that's a good point, because that's the way, because like people will say, well, how do I know if I'm a nice guy? How do I know if I'm using covert contracts? The way you usually know it is that you feel resentful and victimized. You're not being appreciated enough. You're not getting back as much as you give. You're not being noticed. You're not being thanked. And if you're kind of ruminating about those things and feeling bitter and resentful, and if that starts manifesting in either passive aggressive behavior, which is, I actually did learn what passive aggressiveness was. You know, it's when you express your anger in indirect kind of ways, like instead of saying, I'm mad at you, or I'd like you to do this, or I'd like you to stop, we poke at them, we jab at them, we embarrass them in public, we shut down, we don't follow through on our commitments, whatever. Those are passive aggressive behaviors. Or nice guys often can go into what I call a victim puke, where the stuff just builds up until boom. It, you know, everything we've ever rehearsed in our head that we wanted to say, because we're so resentful, just comes out. And I remember when I was doing most of my work, and when I wrote No More Mr. Nice Guy, I was in my second marriage. And I mean, I had to learn a lot. I had to grow up a lot. And I remember I'd have one of these victim pukes with my then second wife. And she, you know, when all was said and done, she said, like, how long has this been bothering you? I'd go, I don't know, 6 months maybe. And she'd go, it never crossed your mind to say something about it? And I go, no, not really. And really it hadn't. It never crossed my mind that maybe I could say, hey, this bothers me. Or, hey, can you do this different? Or, hey, can you stop doing that? Or, hey, can we talk about this? It just built and built and built. That's a pretty clear sign that you're a nice girl or a nice guy, that all these things you do for other people actually start taking a toll. They start building up in terms of resentments and perhaps rage and frustrations, and they get manifest in those passive aggressive ways or in the occasional victim puke.
Okay. So say somebody's listening to this and is realizing that they exhibit some of these traits of a overly nice person. What are the first steps in figuring out how to, I guess, start expressing healthy emotion?
Okay. That's a good question. And I'll tell you how I started. And I found that this seems to be a pretty good starting place. And I mentioned that I went to a 12-step group, and I didn't know where else to go, but my wife was telling me, you're a sex addict. And so I thought, well, I don't think so. I'm not having very much sex. I'm not sure how involved. But so I went to this 12-step group for sex addiction, and it was all men. And it met like at 6 a.m. in the morning. And I was in my early 30s at the time, and I went, and I did quickly find out I wasn't a sex addict. But for the first time in my life, I had a safe place to just open up and reveal me, to talk about me, both my hurts, my pains, anything that I repressed, behaviors I'd never told anybody about, thoughts and impulses I never told anybody about. And I actually got excited about getting up once a week, you know, to be at this meeting at 6 a.m. in the morning to just reveal me and talk about me. And soon, right at that same time, I also got with a therapist that I started working with maybe 6 months or so later. I got with into a men's group that I was in for 4 or 5 years. And I'm still today in a men's program I've been in for 3 years. And the number one place to start is go find a safe person or a safe place and start revealing you. Now, this does a few things. One, it lets you start releasing that internalized, unconscious, toxic shame, that core belief that I'm not okay, I'm not good enough. Now, I found, I'll just distinguish, I found in nice guys, and I'm sure it's true in nice girls as well, there are two types of nice guys. One is the, I call it, I'm so good nice guy. The other is the I'm so bad nice guy. I fit in the I'm so good nice guy category. I think I do everything so well, everybody should think I'm great. Now, deep down inside in this really dark, tightly locked box is my toxic shame that I work really hard to avoid ever having to feel or experience, the sense that I'm not okay. That's why I work so hard to be good, is because deep inside, I don't feel okay. That's the I'm so good nice guy. If everybody got to know me, everybody would love me. The I'm so bad nice guy is often the guy that started rebelling or acting out, oppositionally defiant behavior at a young age, maybe start drinking, doing pot, dropped out of school, you know, fucked up a lot, and then maybe, you know, got married or had a kid or found Jesus or got in the military and they got their life in order. But now they're trying to be a nice guy, but deep inside, they still think if anybody gets close to me, they're going to find out how messed up I really am. So that's the I'm so bad nice guy. So by finding a safe person, a coach, a therapist, a group, a 12-step program, a minister, rabbi, whatever, and beginning to reveal yourself, you begin to release toxic shame. And that is so unburdening, so liberating. And you start getting more accurate feedback from a safe person as to who you really are.
Yeah.
And you might say, I'll give you an example. I was leading a men's workshop several years ago, and there was a guy in there, early 40s, African-American, and he just carried so much toxic shame. And so during this workshop, I just asked him, what is your deepest shameful thing about you? And he told a story that when he was like 14, he stole a car stereo. And because of that, ever since, he's just believed he's the most terrible human being. And like all the other men in this workshop looked at him. It was a small group, about 8-10 guys. And they said, really? That's it? We all did stupid stuff when we were 14. You know, that's like probably small change. And like he got accurate information that doing a stupid 14-year-old thing did not make him a horrible person. And that one thing was just liberating to him, that he could quit beating himself up for being this terrible person. So we get more accurate feedback as to who we are. By revealing ourselves as safe people, we also get to practice being honest. And that was such a big thing for me. Nice guys think we're so great. We're so this, we're so that, give us a parade, give us confetti, whatever. But the truth is most nice guys are extremely dishonest. We only reveal what we think, you want to hear. We hide anything that might get the negative reaction. We twist the truth. We leave it out. We embellish it. We misdirect your attention. And so one of the first things I realized I had to do was just start being an honest person. So being in a safe environment let me practice telling my entire truth with people that weren't going to like overreact or abandon me. That then let me begin practicing it with the people who I was most afraid of overreacting or abandoning me, family, partner, good close friends. And so having that safe place lets us release shame, get more accurate information of who we are, and it lets us practice being a more honest person. So that is where I recommend people start.
This is so interesting. Okay. I'm very glad I had you on. I had a great time with like Adam Lane Smith. I was like, this all makes sense. It's so interesting. So this is very cool. So that's why Al-Anon is such a huge thing, right? Because you connect with somebody and who cares if like, what's the risk of telling them your deepest, darkest secrets? It's not like your family, right? They're not necessarily going to care.
Yeah. I'll tell you a short story. When I was like, say, early in this process, I was in this 12-step group and I had a therapist, a female therapist. And pretty early on, I had a dark sexual impulse. I didn't act on it, but just the fact that I noticed myself having this dark impulse really scared me. Now, the old previous me probably never would have let that impulse even get into conscious awareness. But when it did, because I was practicing letting stuff come into conscious awareness, it scared me. It scared me. I didn't act on it. And that felt good, but it felt bad that I even could think something so dark. And so I went to my 12-step group and told them this dark impulse that I had. And, the only reaction you ever get in a 12-step group is, thank you for sharing. That's it. Nobody goes, oh, you're a horrible human being. How could you even think of something? It's just thank you for sharing. And most of the guys in this group, their lives were so friggin' out of control. They're probably thinking, that's it. That's the worst. that's the worst you got to bring to us. So I told them, and it was such a relief to just speak it out loud and just not carry it around inside of me, where eventually it would have either kept fueling a lot of shame for having the impulse, or perhaps it might have even gotten acted on, right? If I didn't deal with it and bring it out in the open. So I went to my 12-step group, told them, no big negative reaction. So I actually had an appointment with my therapist like an hour after the group. So I drove over to her office and I'm thinking same thing. I'm going to tell this female therapist, this dark sexual impulse. She's going to think I'm a terrible human being, blah, blah, blah. But I told her and just, I told her the impulse and she just looked at me with compassion and said, well, let's explore what that story's about. And like, I'm going, that's it? That's as terrible of a reaction as I'm going to get. So I get done with the therapy session. Mm-hmm. I'm driving home. My second wife, I used to tell her that her middle name ought to be Overreact because that's what she did in every situation. And so I'm driving home to Miss Overreact to tell, and I'm thinking, I got to tell her. I already told my 12-step group, already told my therapist, I'm batting 1,000. If I tell her and she overreacts and has a terrible reaction to it, I'm still 666, great batting average, no problem. And so I'm driving home, soothing myself, right? And not rehearsing the story, because if I'm just going to tell her the truth, I just got to tell her the truth. Yeah. And I get home and I say, I got something I got to talk with you about. Took her back to the bedroom. We sat on the bed. And I said, here's the thing. I said, I want you to already talk to my 12-step group, already talk to my therapist. But the thing I want to tell you about is I had this impulse. I didn't act on it, but I had it. I've talked about it. I've gotten it out. I needed to tell you about it. And she just looked at me and said, that kind of scares me. It doesn't surprise me. And I'm glad you told me. And she never brought it up again, never reacted, never used it against me. And I'm sitting there thinking, this is like magic. You know, all you have to do is just reveal, just tell. And you know, it's when we're keeping the secrets and hiding the things that people sense something is wrong and out of whack. That's what most people are reacting to, is what yeah. doesn't seem true or aligned. And me just sitting down and saying, here's the truth, after having already practiced that with safe people, let me then do it with somebody that I did have fear that she might have a negative reaction. And I'm grateful that she didn't. And that because that helped reinforce, I can keep revealing myself and I can handle whatever the reaction is that people might have.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I like that you pointed out it's the hidden things that create fear that people are reacting to. It's like, yeah. What are you not saying? How bad could it be? And I guess if you shove something down in yourself and you think it's that bad, you're going to give off those, I don't know, that energy that people around you, like, look how bad a person I am.
Yeah.
Even if it's not necessarily that bad. Yeah.
They do sense it. I mean, I tell men that, for example, that I found that women are especially sensitive to this energy, to repressed energy. They get it. That now I know a lot of women will like then project what they think it's about. But
yeah,
I'll tell guys, for example, let's say you're driving down the street with your girlfriend or your wife or whatever, and you've got gas and you don't want to rip one right there. And so you're repressing, you're holding the gas back. You're being a good person, a good citizen, right? By not ripping a fart, you know, while you're driving down the road, but you're repressing something and not saying anything about it. Your woman is sitting there next to you going, there's something up. There's something going on with it. He's holding something back. He's repressing something. Oh, I know. He was looking at that woman's breast on the corner back there, and he's still thinking about her breast. He's thinking, you know, and then the woman will create this big story.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they're having some big fight because she'll accuse him of the thing that she projected. And he was just trying to be a good guy and, you know, holding gas back. And that goes on all the time in relationships, is one person holding back and the other person sensing it, having some visceral reaction to it, and often creating a story to go with it. That's usually a projection of their own personal story from their own past experiences. And now all of a sudden, you know, they're often fighting about something that didn't even happen, but something was happening that never got spoken of. It's the meta thing. Most people never really fight about the thing they're fighting about. They're fighting about some meta type thing, but now they're arguing about this, but it's usually something different than that.
Okay. This is good. I'm going to get some practical advice then. What should people who, let's do it for the parents. Say you're a single mom or a single dad,
okay.
Which is already like, there's going to be some stress in that. How do you help your kid to not develop this nice guy syndrome?
The best way I know to do that is through modeling. And probably you're aware of that, that you know, if your daughter sees you doing certain things, she'll probably model it. You know, most they say, for example,
yes.
most children that smoke grew up seeing adults smoke, or, you know, most that develop drinking issues saw adults. Now, that's not always the case, but our children model our behavior for good and for bad. So if going back to what I was talking about, of you filling your own bucket up, for example, If your daughter sees you consciously surrounding yourself with lots of resources, those cooperative, reciprocal relationships I was talking about, where it's you and your friends, it's you and professionals that you have in your life, your doctor, your dentist, your chiropractor, your accountant, your co-workers, and you are consciously getting what you need to fill your bucket from those resources as you also give. You and I right now have a cooperative reciprocal relationship. We both agreed to be here. We both assume we'll get something, a benefit out of being here together. And, you know, if after we're said and done, if either one of us decided that wasn't worth the time or investment, we probably wouldn't do it again. But if both of us felt like, hey, that was worthwhile, that was beneficial, we would very definitely consider doing that again. That's what a cooperative reciprocal relationship is. So if your daughter, for example, sees you spending time with your girlfriends, exercising, eating healthy, meditating, going for walks in the park, laughing, having fun, surrounding yourself with goodness that fills your life, fills your bucket, then you're giving to her from the overflow, and she will then model those same behaviors. A good model for this is a guy named M. Scott Peck wrote a book called The Road Less Traveled. It's probably 40 years old. I've heard it's the all-time best-selling self-help book. And there's a whole chapter in there on discipline, a whole section on love. And he says love, I'm going to paraphrase it, is the giving to oneself or to another in a way that promotes one's or another's spiritual growth. Now, you could also just say well-being, okay? And he says, and I teach this in a lot of my programs, he has this really cool model that I've expanded on. He says if the parents are meeting their needs in a timely, judicious way, filling their own bucket up, if they have healthy, differentiated relationship with each other, to where mom and dad aren't in what I call an ownership fused relationship, which is you belong to me, therefore you should constantly fill my bucket up because I feel so empty. That's how most of us do our intimate relationships. But if our partner is just one more of our cooperative reciprocal relationships, just one of many bucket fillers that we have in our life, and we're one for them as well, both mom and dad's buckets are going to be filled. And then Peck says, if the parents can then take the time to pay attention to each of their child's needs and respond to their needs in timely and judicious ways. And I add consistent to that list because I think consistency is a real important key. So if you as a mom are filling your own bucket, you're surrounded with good resources to keep your bucket full, to keep you energized. You can then pay attention to, you'll have time to pay attention to your daughter. You'll see what her own particular needs are in any given moment. You'll give to them in timely ways. You'll give to her in judicious ways. And as I'm sure you've already found out, giving judiciously to our children requires the wisdom of Solomon. You know, do you give your 11-year-old, wait till she's, it'll probably come before 11. It'll probably happen at 9. Maybe it's already happened. She comes home and says, Mom, I need an iPhone. I need an iPhone. Like a 12. Two. Yeah. So I need an iPhone. And you know your 11-year-old doesn't need an iPhone because it's probably not good for her to have an iPhone, but maybe every one of her friends has an iPhone and you don't want her to feel left out and not a part. And what do you do with that? I mean, it seems like a not that important decision, but those are the important decisions of judicious giving to your children. So if you're giving to your child judiciously and consistently, Peck says that a child internalizes at the emotional level. So we're going back to talking about our emotional internalization, our emotional operating system. The child will internalize, I am important, I'm lovable, I'm valuable. That's number one. Number two, my needs are important. And number three, that the world is like my family. Now, if that doesn't happen, if children don't get their needs met in timely, judicious way, they internalize the opposite. I'm not lovable, valuable, or important. My needs are not important. And the world is like my family. So they're going to go out into the world interacting with the world like nobody's going to love me or meet my needs unless I like give to them first or use whatever my survival mechanism is. But there's one more internal belief system that children develop if their parents are not doing a very effective job of meeting their own needs and then giving to the child in timely, judicious, consistent ways. Often the parent will use the child to come meet some of their needs, emotional needs, social needs, needs for physical connection. And when a child is used to meet a parent's need, it's called parentification. The child will always believe that they're not good enough. Because remember, children are grandiose and narcissistic and egotistical. If mom is sad and leaning on their child, the child thinks, I should make mom not sad. But because mom is sad in ways that a child can't fix and continues to be sad, the child internalizes, I'm not good enough. I can't make mom be not sad. I can't make dad not be angry. So the child also develops that fourth belief system, I'm not good enough, and then goes out into the world and interacts with the world thinking, I'm not valuable, I'm not lovable, my needs aren't important, and I'm not good enough. But going back to your question, if you've been consistently, judiciously, timely meeting your daughter's needs, not perfectly by any means, but just, you know, shooting for, you know, being good enough, your child will internalize the belief system. I'm valuable. I'm important. My needs are important. And as I go out into the world, as I go to preschools, I go to kindergarten, as I go to school, as I start dating in junior high, as I, you know, on and on, I'm going to believe that I'm valuable. My needs are important. And the world is going to respond in kind. And I don't know about you, but I think about that at times. What would it have been like to have been in junior high thinking, I'm valuable, I'm lovable, my needs are important, and everybody else recognizes that? I'm thinking how powerful that would be. And so that's how we raise our children, to develop this internalized system where they don't have to be using their defense mechanisms or survival mechanisms or covert contracts. Now, we're not going to get it perfect. None of us do. We all had imperfect parents. We're going to be imperfect parents. We're going to raise imperfect children. And in fact, giving yourself permission to be an imperfect parent and letting your child be an imperfect child, it's one of the greatest gifts that you can give them. Because I see a lot of parents nowadays wanting their children to be perfect so they can feel like perfect parents. You know, these helicopter parents that go, you're going to study this, you're going to go to this camp and this camp and this camp, and you're going to make these grades, and you're going to go to this kind of college. You know, that helicopter parent, that's a burden on a child. It doesn't let the child differentiate and just be who they are. Maybe the child just wants to be an artist or play music or travel the world. But no, you're going to get into MIT, you're going to get into Stanford, you're going to make the good enough grades to get that. That creates also that belief in children that they're not good enough, and they've got to be perfect to be loved. So letting your child be their imperfect self is also a great gift to give your child.
Okay, so how about this? And what I'm trying to do with Scarlett is exactly what you're saying. And so I've been, you know, interviewing people and learning a lot, and I've seen a massive difference in our relationship in the last like year or two. So things are going really well. But just to play devil's advocate, if you raise your kid thinking, and I'm not going to be doing this, but if you do raise your kid and they end up thinking they're not good enough, does that lead to individuals who try and be better and are more motivated and end up being more successful?
Well, it depends on our definition of success. Okay, so that's a good question.
Not happy, like maybe from the outside, looking successful.
Yeah, and that's a good question. And of course, we can look around and see that, and maybe we see it in ourselves, is that, yeah, there's a part of me that wants to achieve a certain degree of success so that, you know, I can feel good about myself and people will value me. And there's a difference. And I think the difference is you just have to feel the difference. For example, I got a PhD at 29 years old. And I think I was motivated. Number one, I almost dropped out of high school. High school just bored me. I was just totally lost and uninterested. Yeah. Once I quit playing sports, I lost interest. And luckily, I got with some really good teachers. I got into debate and got into some stuff that energized me. Then all of a sudden, you know, studying and making good grades felt just internal. It felt interesting. I wanted to apply myself. Now, well, you could try to make grades, trying to make good grades by trying to look good or get approval or validation. Or by the time I got to college then and through college and then through graduate school, I maintained about a 3.8 grade point average. And I think there was some part of me that was, look at me. I made these kind of grades, but not a very big part of me. Most of it just was, I can do this. This feels good. And that's the difference of how it feels. And where I'm at in life right now, I'm 65 years old. Most people start like thinking about retiring at my age. I have no interest in retiring. And I don't even know what that would look like. I'd still get up and do what I do. And I got nothing else that I have to prove to anybody or accomplish. And so I'm purely motivated by the love of doing what I do. It just excites me. I mean, just two experiences that, you know, before you and I started your call, your producer said, "Robert, I read your book. It was really powerful at an important time in my life." I said, "Thank you for telling me that. That feels good, right? That my ego isn't built on that, but it felt good knowing that I made a difference." And it felt good when I heard Adam Lane Smith, somebody that I don't know personally, say a really nice thing about me on your podcast. I thought, I had to turn the podcast off and just sit with it and just sit with it and think, That was so out of left field. I didn't see that coming. And it just, because I didn't. And I just thought, wow, that felt really good. Now, I don't do what I do to try to keep getting that, you know, those nice words and nice things. I do what I do because I love what I do. And I'm glad that it makes a difference and has an impact on people's life. So, for example, with you and your daughter, you could try, well, I'm going to do this and do this, and then she'll be a happy child, and I'll look like a good parent, and I'll, you know, blah, 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 blah. And that's that external validation kind of thing that's driven from not feeling good enough inside. But if you just enjoy the experience of being a mother with your daughter and just love to death just being a mom with her, then you're just going to be you. It's going to feel good. It's going to feel natural. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to snap at her occasionally. You're going to let her hear things you didn't wish you didn't hear. But you know what? It's okay. Because, you know you're open-hearted and loving towards her. It just feels different than that feeling of my child's got to get good grades. She's got to look good. She's got to make a good impression. She's got to make me look like a good mom. It just feels different. And you can just check inside to feel the difference in it.
Yeah. So you have to start being like brutally honest about that underneath all the lies you've told yourself or the stories you've been brought up with or something, feel if it's a good thing or a bad thing. And you can start that, like you said, by starting to be honest with people that if they respond negatively, it doesn't really matter in your life, I guess. Because then you're more open to talking to them.
And I love the idea of just being brutally honest with yourself, because that's where it has to start. And, you know, as I said, I've got a son. I've raised stepkids as well. My son's a good kid, and I'm proud of him, and I love him to death. And I can remember, because both he and my stepson were about the same age, and they were both really good in sports. And I loved going to their games and being the proud papa. And I almost always made sure the people around me know, that quarterback, that's my son, you know, or the guy that just hit the home run, that's my son. And I'm thinking that was me parentifying my child. That was me, in a sense, using my children to feel like a good person. Now, I'm human. I did it. And it wasn't a terrible thing, but I'm also honest with myself that was me parentifying my children. That was not letting them just be them for the sake of being them and me being happy for them, right? I was feeding off of it in some kind of way. Okay, we're all going to do some of those kind of things. And you know what? It's okay. We're imperfect. But if we're brutally honest with ourselves, we notice ourselves doing it and we go, I'm going to try not to do that in the future because I don't think that's probably the healthiest thing for my child. And we work on it. So it does begin with being brutally honest with ourselves.
That's got to be tricky to figure out exactly like where you're coming from when you're displaying some sort of emotion, because couldn't you have been saying the same thing on the sidelines, but it wouldn't have been parentifying? That's what you said.
Yes. And I'll go back to the difference of the two examples I gave of your producer and Adam Lane Smith. Yeah. I didn't go out seeking their approval, right? I don't know either of them. And they both said some very kind things to me and about me. And it felt good. Now, I could then go out and try to keep getting other people to say those same kind of things about me because it felt so good. Or I could just soak it in and let it be there. So yes, you can be proud of when your child excels at something and just smile and soak it in and go, I'm so amazingly proud of this human being that I call my child.
Okay.
You notice the difference. You notice when I'm hoping this person next to me knows that's my son out there playing quarterback, because then they'll be impressed with me, you know. And I've done the same thing with my dogs. You know, I've got right now a 1-year-old pit bull, and I just want everybody to think I've just got the coolest dog. And it's the same kind of thing. It's that external validation. I used to have a Weimaraner years ago. Same thing. Everybody thought my dog was so cool. I loved walking down the street. Oh, that's a cool looking dog, you know. And that's that external validation that you can get addicted to, right? And we can do that with our kids. We can do it with our partner. We can do it with our successes in life. Oh, look at the things that I've accomplished. You know, look at the car I'm driving. Look at the house I live in. Look at the boat I have. And it's great to have a great car. It's great to have a great house. If you like boats, it's great to have a great boat. But do it because you love the car. You love driving the car. You love driving the boat. You love living in your house, not because, look what I've attained. Look, what are people going to think of me, you know, when I drive up in my great car in front of this great house? I mean, that's a never-ending addictive cycle. And, you know, I think it all goes back still to just filling our lives with those cooperative reciprocal relationships. We're filling our own bucket up, which makes us feel loved and valuable and that our needs are important. And then we don't need all the external stuff to get some sense of validation.
Do you think a lot of the reason that marriages don't work is because people don't have enough friendships as well? And they're looking to their partner for everything. And it's just not possible.
You teed that one up for me nicely. Thank you. I think there's a number of reasons relationships don't work. I'm not sure they're meant to work. I'm not sure they're part of our human evolutionary DNA to have pair-bonded, lifelong, intimate relationships with the opposite sex.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, our ancestors did not do that for 1.5 million years. We've been trying to do it for less than 10,000 years, and it's never really worked real well. But that's why we have religion and a lot of rule systems to say you have to do it. And if you don't, you're a failure, kind of, you know, shaming people into trying to make it work. So I don't believe that they actually are meant to work in the way we think that they are. I mean, even the whole idea of romantic love, I heard sometime that, you know, that's only been around about 200 years that we're going to get with somebody because we love them. And that I heard that Shakespeare wrote Romeo and Juliet to show the extreme fallacy of romantic love. Oh, we love each other so much, let's kill ourselves. You know, it's silly. But I do believe that relationships can be powerful personal growth machines. I say that all the time, if we approach them consciously and realistically. You know, if I get with my partner and think, oh, because I think you're beautiful and because I think your body's hot, therefore you're going to be an amazing partner to me, we're in trouble. Right. Or if you get with a guy because you think, oh, man, he's 6'2" and he's got a nice build and, you know, he makes a lot of money, he'll make a great partner. No, the things we base our decisions on for getting with people often, you know, I tell men all the time, because I mainly work with men now. I say, you know, everything your male brain thinks that a woman can do for you is wrong. And I tell women the same thing. Everything your female brain thinks a man can do for you is wrong. But if two conscious people are willing to accept the challenges, the difficulty of trying to create an intimate pair-bonded relationship with a member of the opposite sex, with all of our baggage from childhood, with all of our relationship fears, with all of our defense mechanisms, with all of our projections, with all of society's unrealistic expectations of how they should work, this, as I said, can be a really powerful personal growth machine. So there's a lot of things that cause relationships not to go long-term. One is that they're probably just not meant to. Number two is that the unrealistic expectations we have of them is another one. How we form these relationships, at least for me, I'm a terrible picker when it comes to relationship. I bumbled my way through every relationship I've got. I think it was Pia Melody, who wrote a lot about codependency. I read this years ago, said that we tend to be attracted to and marry a person who has some of the worst traits of both of our parents.
Oh my God.
So just, yeah, let that sink in. That means unconsciously we get attracted to people that are giving us the opportunity to work out our dad issues and work out our mom issues. And that person picked us because we're giving them the opportunity to work out their dad issues and their
mom
issues.
That's horrible.
And then we expect that's going to work for a lifetime and we're going to be happy the entire lifetime. Okay. But if we know that, if we can be conscious of those pieces, we can actually watch that stuff coming up and work with it, especially if we have help, if we have, you know, coach, therapist, good resources. So back to your question, and it goes back to the whole differentiation thing. I think this idea of this pair bonded, lifelong, intimate relationship with a member of the opposite sex, like I said, it's only existed. We've only tried to do it for a few thousand years. And what does happen is that a lot of people who are not filling their own buckets up with a lot of cooperative reciprocal relationships come into relationship feeling needy. We find somebody we're attracted to and is basically, come fill my bucket, meet my needs. Now, what makes this worse is that when most couples get together, they start giving up whatever they had going on in their life that made them who they were when they met. You know, maybe they start demanding that of each other. Well, you need to quit hanging around with your guy friends. You need to quit hanging around with your girlfriends, or, you know, you need to spend more time with me, or you need to not go out as much at night. Years ago, I knew somebody is actually a friend of a friend. But when this couple met, the guy played on 3 softball teams. So he was playing softball all the time. They met, dated. He continued to play softball. They got married. And his wife said, now that we're married, you have to quit playing on so many softball teams. And I'm thinking, that's not a fair request. You know, they met when they, you know, and she never said ahead of time, if we get married, I expect you to play on fewer softball teams. But here's the deal. It's just an example of we do this in spoken or unspoken ways. It's kind of like, you're my girlfriend, therefore you should. You're my boyfriend, therefore you should. You're my wife, therefore you should. Therefore, that's why I call them ownership relationships. This is the definition of a fused relationship. I don't have all these other things out here filling my bucket up, so therefore you should. And you better, because I've given up all these things to be in a relationship with you that I did have when we met. I'm even emptier now than I was, so I expect even more. You should fill me up. And they're not the same person that they were when you met. You're not the same person. So we've increased the odds of this not working well by giving up the things we did have in our life. So to answer your question, when I was doing marriage therapy, almost religiously in the first session with the couple, I would tell them, usually before the end of the session, the best thing both of you can do for your marriage is develop good same-sex relationships. The guy needs to have good guy friends. The woman needs to have good girlfriends. Now, what I found working with a lot of nice guys is a lot of men I work with don't have many good guy friends. And I tell men, having good guy friends is the foundation that you're going to build a healthy relationship on with a woman. And so what happens is they meet a woman and they make her their best friend, and they want her to be everything for them. And many women do the same thing as well. So yes, I agree that the best thing we can do with our marriage in the beginning is, if we don't have them already, develop good relationships. Now, I take this seriously. I mentioned I've been in a men's program for 3 years. I've been married to my present wife a little over 4.5 years. She's Mexican. We live in Mexico. She doesn't speak English. I've had to learn Spanish in my 50s and 60s. My stepkids don't speak English, even though they're supposed to be learning. And so here I am, kind of isolated, you know, because my Spanish has gotten better, but I'm not fluent Mexican style fluent. I can't swear as good as the average Mexican, even though my wife does her best to teach me. And you know, I didn't have many guy friends down here. You know, I'm now raising kids again. I work at home. My gym is in my house, you know, so
yeah,
I just didn't have many male connections. And I knew the well-being of my marriage was dependent on me having good guy friends. And so I was actually leading a workshop talking about this cooperative reciprocal relationship idea, and had some handouts that I was working with the guys. And I told them one of the things I need to add to my list that I need to add to my list of cooperative reciprocal relationships is a men's program. I need to be with men. And then when I got done, one of the guys in my program said, Robert, I'm in a men's program. You know, we meet two or three times a year for retreats. We meet online. It's really great. And he told me who the coach was and who he trained with. And I love the guy that he trained with. And I said, I'm in. And so I joined 3 years ago. I'm about to start my fourth year. Every year, there's about 35 to 45 of us. We have retreats. And
wow,
it's just blessed my life and has improved my marriage. And it's made me more grounded. My wife has either met or gotten to know a number of the men that I know. Some have been to my home. You know, if I'm on Zoom talking to them, I'll say, come here, say hi to the, you know, this particular friend. And so me, even in my 60s, still trying to bumble my way through marriage and relationship, I just know if I don't go spend time with men, if I don't have the support of men, if I can't be revealing myself to men, I'm going to go downhill and my marriage is going to go downhill with it. So yes, I agree with you. We need good same-sex friends, and we need to take the focus off of our partner that he or she should always be there to meet all of our needs. They can't.
Okay. Robert, thank you very much for coming on. I asked about two of the questions I had. I had a whole list of them. That was very, very interesting. That was very interesting. Thank you. If people want to follow you or find out more about you, where should they go?
Just drglover.com is to find everything I've got. If they Google my name or Google No More Mr. Nice Guy, I've got all the top spots. But yeah, drglover.com, and yeah, come find out who I am.
Okay. Well, thank you for coming on.
You're welcome. Thanks for the invitation. This was fun.